Unfortunately, this is a story about my earlier life at Cornell. I've slowed down a bit since. I'm not giving the last talk here. I'm giving the last two talks here because I'm actually giving a couple of talks, as you might have seen from the description. This is something everybody tells their graduate students not to do, right? You've got a great thesis. You've got these two things. Don't talk about both of them. So I'm going to talk about both of them. Before I do that, I want to talk about a couple of other talks. The last two talks by Kim and Steve, those were terrific. I have to mention that because we went out to lunch in Chinatown, and Steve found a fortune cookie with a little message in, someone will say something nice about your work or something like that. So, of course, he passed it over to me, and so I have to do this. Also, I didn't want to mention that, so maybe someone else will say something tomorrow about Steve's talk. The other thing is you really shouldn't be here because I left the hotel this morning and I saw Dan Spielman, who we both did this sort of double take. He's here giving a series of lectures in math, and the first one is right now, so if you want to sneak out, I will turn around. It's on electrical engineering and Laplacians of graphs, and he's giving two more talks tomorrow, which won't conflict with our workshop, and on Friday, so if you want to go to those, if you're still around, I'm sure they'll be terrific. I want to thank the organizers for fixing my talk right on top of those. It's been a great meeting. Nice small number of talks, but as I said, I'm going to give you two talks. So the first one is maybe not quite dyslexic, but has those two words robust in there, and after the first time I submitted this, I realized I had to put a special note that it really was meant to be a robust optimization result. The second one is not to do with optimization at all, but to do with an acute problem on acute triangles, the probability that a random triangle is acute. And when Antoine invited me, I said I could talk about either one of these things, and he actually chose the second one because he really likes geometry, and I said it didn't have much to do with optimization, and then I said, maybe I'll do them both. So this is sort of an abbreviated version of this. If you want to see more, you can go to my website, which is here. This is joint work with Martina Gankarova. So here's the problem we're looking at. It's an optimization problem. We're maximizing a linear function over a set C. All I assume about C is it's non-empty and convex. Since I'm interested in the optimal value, it might as well be convex, but there are some applications where I don't want to assume that. So it may be hard to find this, but I'm looking at that optimal value. And we heard earlier this week about environ metrics, and in fact, I thought about this when I was at a workshop on computational sustainability. All sorts of fascinating applications, and some of them are using math programming models, but who knows where they got their objective function from, right? I mean, they were trying to do something, and they came up with some possibly fake objective function, and I sort of wondered, how much do you lose if you actually come up with the wrong objective function? So the viewpoint here is rather different from traditional robust optimization. Here, C, the feasible region, is going to be fixed. In some of the applications, it's something that comes from some combinatorial optimization problem. There's no data in there that's uncertain, but the objective function is we're not clear what the objective function is. In robust optimization, you have sophisticated users who choose their solution that they propose, knowing that there's uncertainty in the data, and sort of protecting themselves, hedging, finding a solution which is guaranteed to be convex and guaranteed to be feasible and guaranteed to get a reasonable amount in the objective function. I'm assuming that, in fact, we have an oblivious, that's a kind way of saying maybe a stupid decision maker who has some sort of routine that optimizes, doesn't really know that V isn't the right objective function, is just going to go ahead and use it anyway. And the point is, if you do use this, you come up with a feasible solution, because I'm assuming C is known, there's the feasible region, but you won't, of course, solve the true problem. The true problem has a different objective function. So how much do you lose in terms of the true objective function? So let's start with a very trivial special case. So this is the model case. C is the unit ball. V is a unit vector. Everything I'm doing is going to be sort of independent of scale, so let's just assume V is a unit, has unit norm. And then if you optimize, we're maximizing here, you maximize V transpose X over the unit ball, you get the optimal solution X equals V. But V isn't exactly the true objective function coefficients, that's W. And let's assume I'm going to just use W, but it's always going to depend on a sort of measure of how inaccurate we are, which is going to be an angle, W of alpha. It's also a unit vector. It makes an angle of alpha somewhere between 0 and pi, with what we know, our so-called nominal V. And of course, our V doesn't get the optimal value. The optimal value, if we knew W, would be 1, but instead we get cosine of alpha. I'll show you a picture in just a second. So we don't achieve the optimal value. We lose a certain amount, and we lose exactly 1 minus cosine of alpha. And of course, this depends on scale, so it might seem reasonable to make it scale independent. So let's look at the range of that true objective function. Right? It can go anywhere from plus 1 to minus 1, so it has a range of 2. So the scaled loss, which I'm going to define as the loss divided by the range, is 1 minus cosine alpha over 2. And two things you should know about, nice simple formula, very small, sort of like alpha squared over 4. If alpha is fairly small, this is pretty tiny. And the amazing thing is that we're going to show that the scale loss formula holds for any C on average. And the on average is in quotes, and you'll see why it's in quotes. Okay? So this oblivious decision maker is not doing too badly on average. You don't lose too much on average, even if you're not protecting for things at all. So this is a model case, and let me just go to the picture to just make it clear. So this is two-dimensional. In fact, everything is really two-dimensional, because if you think about it, we're thinking about two objective functions, and all that matters is the projection of the feasible region C onto the plane spanned by V and W. So everything is really two-dimensional. V points straight up. V stands for vertical. So there's our optimal solution right up there. But the true objective vector is pointing in this direction. There's the true objective optimal solution. We're using this one instead. What do we get? We actually get this as our objective value. That's our cosine of alpha. True one is 1. This is how much we lose. What we lose is in red. The whole range is red and green, and the ratio is that 1 minus cosine alpha over 2. If anything isn't clear, it's long day, you've had your coffee, this should be very easy. This is just two-dimensional geometry. So there's the loss, 1 minus the scale loss, 1 minus cosine alpha over 2, which I say holds on average. So this is sort of what robust means. Robust means it's relatively stable. If we don't know V, we don't lose too much. Robust means this actually holds for any feasible region C. Okay, it doesn't matter what the C is. On average, you'll lose this much, whatever on average means. Important points. This is a model case, but it illustrates a modeling issue. So the way I've set it up here, I gave you the V first. The V is what the decision maker knows and sort of what's there. But this is a stupid way to model things, right? The way you should model things is the real problem is given by C and W. W is the true objective function that comes from somewhere or other. And then V is some perturbation because of stupidity of who's measuring things or inaccuracies or whatever. So we really should be generating W first and then V from it, and we'll come back to this later. Okay, so this is illustrated what we're going on. Here's a few definitions making things precise. We'll say max of V. We're always interested in just how these things depend on the objective vector V. Max of V is the maximum value. Min of V is the minimum value. Range is the difference of the two. How much do we lose? And I'll illustrate this in the next case, another model case, but a rather unsatisfactory one. How much do we lose? So loss VW is the maximum possible loss we can get in terms of the true objective value when we implement the worst possible solution, which is still optimal for the nominal objective value. Right? We know V, we're going to optimize V, but maybe if there's a whole bunch of optimal solutions, we may choose the worst one of them. So here we see max of W, that's what we want to achieve, and now we're looking at all of the points that achieve the maximum for V, and of those points we choose the one which has the worst value of the true objective value and we take the difference. That's our loss, sort of looking pessimistically. And then the scaled loss is this ratio of loss VW divided by range. Okay, so here are the definitions. Okay, so I showed you the model case, everything looked good. Here's another case. So the feasible region here is the line segment, the horizontal line segment over here from minus 1, 0 to 1, 0. V stands for vertical, it's pointing straight up. What are the optimal solutions? Everywhere along here, everything is optimal. The true objective value points slightly to the right, sine alpha, cosine alpha. And if we look at this objective, well, all of these are optimal for V, but this is the worst one as far as this objective W. In fact, it's the worst of all feasible solutions. All feasible solutions are optimal for V. So, you know, this is all red. There's no green at all. The scale loss here is 1. Scale loss is between 0 and 1, but this is a terrible case. So what we're trying to argue is even for nasty feasible regions like this, on average, we're still going to get this 1 minus cosine alpha over alpha. Okay, so this clearly says we're going to be in trouble if we look at all possible cases, so we have to do something. If you look at the paper, we also talk about a worst-case setting where we do restrict the feasible region. And for people in optimization, the restriction is something very natural. We assume it contains a ball and is contained in a ball, and then you can get a bound on the worst case this can possibly be, depending on that ratio of little r over big R. But we're going to go a different way. We're going to talk about a probabilistic way, as I said, on average. And if I want to throw a sort of third robust in there, I'd like this result to be sort of independent of what model I choose. I'm going to give you three probabilistic models. The first two are based on standard Gaussian. And I mean, one of the things that's linking this with geometry is standard Gaussians are just beautiful things for understanding what's going on geometrically. They're the first things you should always choose. You know, they're incredibly restrictive. If you're trying to generate a random linear programming problem, you shouldn't believe they're really there, but that's always the first case you should look at. And so that's what we're going to use, and that's going to link this talk with the second talk. So the first thing we're going to do is just choose two vectors, V and U, independently drawn from what I call the standard Gaussian distribution, N0i, which means each component is standard Gaussian and they're independent. So we choose V and U, and then we set W of alpha to being cosine of alpha times V plus sine alpha times U. Okay, so what do we know about this V and W? Well, as the dimension gets high, the angle between these two clusters around alpha. So they're not exactly alpha apart, but you get this concentration. So it's sort of is a good measure for how much these two objective values differ. And notice here I've said we generate V and U, and then from those we generate W. This is the same sort of modeling fallacy I mentioned before. We should really think of W first and then generate V as a perturbation. But the nice thing about this distribution is it turns out that WV has exactly the same distribution as VW. So we could do it the other way around. In terms of the analysis, it's nicer to think of V first, V having this distribution, and W being perturbed, but it's completely symmetric. So it does fit in with how your intuition says you should do things. And whenever we talk about this distribution, we'll use E1 to denote expectations. Second one also is going to tie in a little bit with the second part of the talk. Now we're going to make our two vectors exactly an angle alpha apart by taking, again, two vectors, and I'm going to call them V bar and W bar independently from N0i. I'm going to take U bar and make it orthogonal to V. This is just a sort of Gram-Schmidt type thing to get me U hat. I'll just project it orthogonal to V. Of course, V bar will be non-zero with probability 1. I'm not going to worry about probability 1 thing, so this is defined. And it'll get me another vector. I'm going to normalize V bar to get V. I'm going to normalize U hat to get U. All norms are Euclidean here. And now I'm going to choose W to be, again, W of alpha, cosine alpha V plus sine alpha U. So what have I done? I've normalized a standard Gaussian V bar to get V. V is going to be uniformly distributed on the sphere. U is also going to be uniformly distributed on a sphere, but now it's the sphere that's orthogonal to V, lower dimensional one. And because it's orthogonal, this W is going to be exactly an angle alpha away from V. And here, you know, there are a number of steps that are going on here, but once again, it's true that VW and WV have the same distribution. So even though it looks as if we're generating W as a perturbation of V, we could think of it the other way around. So this one we'll call E2. And both of these have a nice sort of geometric, nice continuous distribution thing of just perturbing things by an angle of something like alpha. Here's a different model, which may be more appealing in some context to think of it like this. And now, instead of making a small sort of change to the angle, we're going to make a radical change to some of the components. So this is actually quite general. Let's think of generating the components from symmetric probability distributions, maybe one for each different J. I don't really mind, as long as it may need some mild restrictions on them, but they don't have to be the same. And for every J, we're going to generate a VJ and a UJ independently from this distribution. And then we'll take our, and we'll do this component-wise by component-wise, we'll take WJ either to be V or to be U. We'll choose it to be V with probability cosine alpha and U with probability 1 minus cosine of alpha. And so, you know, if alpha is small, most of them will be exactly the same as V, and a small proportion will be completely different, generated from the same distribution, but with no relation. And once again, not too hard to see, WV and VW have exactly the same distribution. Again, it's symmetric. And under some mild conditions on the S, the angle will concentrate around alpha between the two. Now it's a certain fraction of the components that are different, but, you know, you just look at inner products and so forth, you'll see this thing works out. So very different sort of viewpoint of what's going on, but again, things will be valid under this model as well. So this is another sort of level of robustness. And now we'll actually do the proofs, and the proofs are easy enough. I mean, I'm not going to give you all the details. The hardest part is to prove that those distributions are symmetric, particularly the second one, but that's not hard either. So very simple results. Almost everything is on the slide, and the proofs are almost here as well. So the first proposition is to do with V versus W and the range and the min and the max. And the first obvious thing is that, you know, if you want to minimize something, you can maximize minus that thing and then switch the sign at the end. So V and W have the same marginal distribution because VW is the same as WV. So I'm just going to state these things for the first distribution, but they're true for all of them. E1 of max W is the same as E1 of max V. What about the range? The range is the same as the range of W and V are both the same. And what's the range of V? Well, that's max minus min. Expectation is linear. Expectation of minus min is expectation of the max of this. And in all of our distributions, V and minus V have the same distribution. So max minus V transpose X has the same distribution as max V transpose X. So we'll just get twice the expectation of the max. Okay, so that's the range. What about the loss? So here, actually, people in this audience probably know quite well, there's this little issue about whether the points that maximize V form a singleton or not, right? Because we have this little thing, we're going to choose the worst possible point. And that would create some sort of dependence between the optimal solution for V, the particular one we're looking at, and the vector W. And that's going to complicate all the arguments. So with probability 1 on any feasible region C that you look at, the support function is differentiable almost everywhere. And that means that, in fact, this optimal solution, XV, is unique for almost all V. Okay, and all of our distributions are absolutely continuous. So we don't really have to, I mean, there's a nasty set of measure zero, but probability one, this thing will be unique, and so we don't have to choose the worst, that's the only one we can choose. So here's our optimal solution when we know the objective function is V, or think it's V. What does that achieve for us with this W alpha? And again, I'm looking at the first model, but it's very similar for the others, we just have to do the scaling first and so forth, but W of alpha was cosine alpha times V plus sine alpha times U. So we get this. So what happens when we take the expectation of this thing? Well, it's linear. We'll have cosine alpha times the expectation of this plus sine alpha times the expectation of this. Well, V transpose XV is just the maximum value, the optimal value with V. So that's just max of V, cosine alpha times max of V, and this is sine alpha U transpose XV. Well, remember, V and U were independent Gaussians, and with probability 1, XV is just only depends on the V, so they're independent, and U has a symmetric distribution, so this has expectation 0. So you put that together, what do you lose? Max of W minus this, expectation of max of W is expectation of max of V, expectation of this is cosine alpha max of V, expectation of max V, plus 0. So we just get 1 minus cosine alpha times the max of V. So, you know, we're all optimizers. We don't know probability. We look as if we're done, right? We've got the range. We've got the loss. We just take the ratio. Well, yes, but what we have is the ratios of the expectations, okay? I don't know how, there's dependence between things. I don't know how to work out the expectation of the ratio, but trivially from these two propositions, we get that the ratio of the expectations is exactly this 1 minus cosine alpha over 2, independent of C. And the arguments are basically the same for the other distributions as well. So you get exactly the same result. Once again, you get this 1 minus cosine alpha over 2. So again, these are the ratio of expectations, not the expectation of the ratio, which I'd really like to get a hold of. So does that matter? So here's a case where we do have lots of test problems, at least for linear programming problems, and these things have been around for over 40 years now. Various things have been added, but I'm just using the little basic ones. So this is a problem called AG. It's a linear programming problem with 488 rows, 163 columns, and it's got a bounded feasible region, so I can optimize in all directions. And this is the sort of difference between the mean of the ratio and the ratio of the means. So this was according to model one, which I think is probably the most natural one. Each one of these things, so along here is an angle in degrees, which you can't read, but I can. This says 40 degrees, 35, 30, 25, and so forth. So for each one of these sort of data points, we generated, I think, 10,000 different objective functions and optimized, and then optimized for V and optimized for W and looked at these ratios. And, well, first of all, they're very small. Again, you can't see this scale either, but this is 0.06, 0.08. So, for example, at 30 degrees off, we're at about 7% loss in optimal value. And again, these things are almost equal to one another. So, I mean, I tend to think of 30 degrees as being quite a lot. This is somewhat misleading. All the pictures you've seen here are two-dimensional. When you get to large dimensions, you take just two random vectors. They're almost orthogonal to one another. So 30 degrees is quite a big correlation between them. But who knows what is appropriate, when someone is modeling something in forest management and uses some objective value, how close it is. But I think this is fairly reasonable. This is Boeing, for people who like Boeing. Very similar picture, very close to each other. To get some idea, I've just been looking at means, either the mean of the ratio or the ratio of the means. If you generate a whole bunch of these things, you get to see the distribution, and they're fairly spread out. Here again is 30 degrees, and this is the sort of 90th percentile and the 10th percentile for AG again, and this goes up to, 11 or 12%, but still, I think it's still fairly reasonable. It gives you an idea that they're not spread out a huge amount. And similarly for Boeing. So, under three probabilistic models, you don't lose much if you don't know the objective function too much. Okay, so I've got 5 minutes before half time, so I'll tell you a little bit about what I left out here. And it's slightly controversial. I told you I left out this thing with the worst case results when you put some assumption on C. But there's some interesting applications of this, if you like, but they're fishy interesting. And one is much more fishy than the other. So all the way through here, to do the analysis, I had to assume I had a linear objective function. And, a lot of people have been talking about nonlinear things and so on. But there's this very fishy sort of application to people who do multi-criterion optimization, where you have a bunch of different objective functions, and a traditional sort of thing to do is to combine those different objective functions with different non-negative weights, and then you optimize that single one, and it's guaranteed to be a Pareto optimal in the set of possible feasible solutions, and different people may differ on what weights you choose, but you get maybe some reasonable feasible solution that does reasonably on all of those criteria. But no one will quite agree on what the weights are, and if you think of this, what you could do is take the original feasible region, take a nonlinear transformation by all of your objective functions, and now you have a feasible region in space given by the number of dimensions, the number of criteria, and now you're optimizing a linear objective function over that. And what is this saying? If you choose the wrong series, set of weights, you don't lose too much compared to the optimal value. Why is this fishy? Why is this very fishy? Well, that's multi-criterion optimization. I'm not going to defend that. Yeah. But why is this application? See, whenever you do this, if you want to maximize all your objectives, it's very unlikely you'll take some with a weight of minus 0.7, right? So your weights are always going to be non-negative. And here, to get all of the results, I was always assuming symmetric distributions. I always had positive and negative. But I think it was worth something, but anyway. So the other application, which is not as fishy, is actually very related to Dan Spielman's work on smooth analysis of algorithms. And I know you're none of you interested in that, or you would be over listening to him instead of listening to me, but this was just a beautiful concept, especially for those of us who have worked in complexity and sort of worst-case things, but also knowing that the simplex method works so well in practice, try to understand its average case behavior. We were always very suspicious of any particular distribution, and so average case, nobody really believed that those results worked, but I think they were at least as unfishy as the applications, the one I just told you. But Spielman and Tang came up with this beautiful intermediate notion, this idea of smooth complexity, that said even if you choose a worst case instance for the linear programming problem, if you take a little distribution around there and you could choose how much variability you put in there, the expected number of steps to solve one of these random problems very close to a bad one was polynomial in the dimensions of the problem, and 1 over the variance. So this was if the variance is 0, this thing obviously blows up and you get terrible worst case behavior. If the variance is huge, you get a nice polynomial, and that's like average case, and this gave a nice interpolation between the two and really explained why algorithms did so well, because of course floating point will help us, right? Floating point will do this little perturbation for us. So there's been a whole bunch of work built on this, and in particular a bunch of people have been looking at combinatorial optimization, say multi-knapsack problems or something like that, and saying again these are NP hard, but under some smooth analysis, and knapsack you don't want to change maybe the constraints, but the objective function switches a little bit, again you have this good complexity result in the smooth analysis setting. And what has that got to do with this? Well, instead of saying, here I have my instance and nearby instances are relatively easy to solve, I say, here I have my instance and I'll myself deliberately perturb it a little bit. Now I know that I can solve that in expected polynomial time, and this says I'm not going to lose very much. Okay, so it just gives you another sort of viewpoint on the smooth analysis stuff. Okay. And now for something completely different. So I think I'll try to make the screen black. That looks good. It's been fun to see that because we have this big picture here, almost everybody has picked up a piece of chalk, and it's nice to see chalk actually being used. So the second part of the talk is the following. It may be the wrong way around, but I'm left-handed. What's the probability that a random triangle is acute? Okay, not a lot of optimization, but I heard about this problem from Alan Edelman, who heard about it from Gil Strang, and the way he described it, he said he was sitting in a rather boring talk, and Gil Strang passed him a little note. Pfft. And he looked at the piece of note, and it said, "Can you do this integral?" And it was an integral with six-dimensional thing. And it was this question exactly. But actually, this has quite a much longer history. And that may be the first person who talked about it. As Lewis Carroll, not as Charles Dodgson. So he wrote a book called Pillow Problems, with things if you wake up in the middle of the night, you may want to think about this. And this was his problem, stated almost exactly like this. Points chosen randomly in the plane. So what does randomly in the plane mean? Well, Dodgson had a rather dodgy way of doing it, and a lot of people since have described how dodgy it is, but you know that these are people who use MATLAB, and people who use MATLAB are going to use, and if they're smart, they will use that. Okay, so you take the columns of a normal zero identity, right? Our favorite distribution. Okay, so what is this probability? One quarter. So this will be mysterious to most people. If you look through high school geometry books, you'll realize the probability that a triangle is acute is about 90%. You look through all the examples. You go to a talk like this, boy, every triangle we've seen has been equilateral, right? I think everybody's drawn an equilateral triangle, but the answer is a quarter. So, this is, as I say, a problem that's been around for a while. The best place to look for articles about this is the American Math Monthly. It's obviously a sort of nice thing to put in there. And the proof I'm going to give you is very similar to one by Portnoy in the 90s, but it's such a cute argument and that I want to talk about. Okay, so let's... So A, B, and C are going to be my three vertices, and well, I'm looking at this, and just as in the half, the first half, you know, there were various things that happened with probability zero, 2 points coalesce, or the points are collinear. Forget about all those with probability one. I'll form a triangle, and this is the event that the triangle is acute. And there's a nice partition of the sample space. Either the triangle is acute, I'm going to say acute means all the angles strictly less than 90 degrees, or maybe the angle at A is bigger than pi over 2, or the angle at B, or the angle at C. Okay, and exactly one of these things can happen. This is Euclidean geometry. And we want to know if the points are generated in this way, what's the probability of this event? And it's obvious, nice symmetry, these three things all have the same probability. So I'm actually, if I want to prove it's a quarter, I'm showing that the probability of each one of these events is a quarter. And so I can choose whichever one I want to prove. And I'm going to prove that EB has probability of a quarter, which I hate doing things that are sort of, you know, not suitably symmetric, but that turns out to be the easiest thing to do. Okay, so I want probability of EB equals one quarter. Now, let's see if I can make this thing go up so I have a bit more room. OK. change setup. No, that doesn't look good. Okay. So, this is just a little picture. So, I'm going to sort of think of B and C somehow as being given to me. Ah, the expert. And... so, let's suppose, say, B is here, and C is there, and think of the different places where A can be, and I said EB here. What's EB? The angle at the node B is greater or equal to pi over 2, so I'll draw this, and this is EB. If A appears over there, the angle at B is going to be bigger than 90 degrees. Here is EC. And you see, both of these are half spaces, which makes things pretty nice. What about the other two, EA and E delta? The angle at A greater or equal to pi over 2, and all of the angles being less than pi over 2. I'll draw a circle here. There's the diameter of the circle. Angle at A greater or equal to pi over 2 is exactly here, right? Because the circle is the locus of places where the angle is exactly 90 degrees. And E delta is stuff up here and stuff down here. So in a sense, you can see why I'm looking at EB. It's the simplest possible set. When I did the sort of symmetric thing and started off with B and C and wondered where A was, it's going to be easier to look at EB than EA. Portnoy looked at EA, and he got a thing with sort of one more random variable around the place. And E delta looks horrible, right? These two disjoint places. Okay, so there's the geometry. And, you know, this thing, the circle and so forth, has center D equals B plus C over 2. And going from D to B, which is sort of the outward normal to this hyperplane, is going in direction E, B minus C over 2. Okay, so we're looking at the circle with diameter D minus E and D plus E, which are B and C. So there's the geometry, right? And we're saying if B, C, and A are all generated in this way, what's the probability that A is over here? Okay, so analysis. I think this thing is partially blocked. I sat over there, so I know that, but... So, A, B, and C are given as independent standard Gaussian vectors. But if I look at this picture, I sort of like D and E more than B and C. I mean, you know, E is the direction I'm looking at to look at EB. So, what shall I do? Well, I'll take D hat, B plus C over square root of 2, and E hat, B minus C over square root of 2. Why did I take square root of 2? Ah, fantastic. Okay, so B plus C over 2 is standard normal, but its variance isn't quite right, and similarly with E. But this guy and this guy are standard Gaussian normal zero identity. And because this is an orthogonal matrix, 1 over square root of 2, 1 over square root of 2, 1 over square root of 2, minus 1 over square root of 2. These are independent normal standard Gaussian vectors. So A, D hat, E hat, independent standard Gaussian vectors. Okay. So, great. Next thing is I want everyone to push their head 10 degrees to the left and think of E as being your first E. You know, it's a standard unit vector, right? But I want you to think of it as being in the direction of the first unit vector. So we can rotate so that E, or E hat, is a positive multiple of the first unit vector. Okay, because Gaussians and another beautiful thing is that the distribution is rotation independent. Okay, so let's start our. Okay, I'll come over here. So one of the problems at the moment is we've got six random variables, right? Six scalar random variables, and that's why little piece of paper had an integral with a six-dimensional integral, and we want to make that as small as possible, and we'll get it down to three, and then we'll appeal to Archimedes, who knew about three-dimensional integrals. That's another story, but okay. So if we've done this, EB, that's the thing we're trying to estimate the probability of. EB is the probability that A is in this right-hand part. The first component of A is greater or equal to the first component of B. First component of A, what's B? B1 is D1 plus E1, which is D1 hat over square root of 2 plus E1 hat over square root of 2. Now, E hat 1 is not a standard Gaussian random variable. Why not? Because I did this rotation to make it a positive multiple of the first unit vector, so E hat 1 is the size of that Gaussian thing, so it's in fact the norm of E hat over root 2. So this is looking a little better. We started off with sort of six scalar random variables, and now we've got A1, D1 hat, E hat 1, and E hat 2, so we're down to 4, but we can go a little bit further. And look at that left-hand side there. That's just a combination of two standard Gaussian random variables, just scalar random variables. A1 minus D hat 1 over square root of 2 has the same distribution as, let's say F1. And this is standard normal. What's its variance? The variance of this is 1. The variance of this is a half. We got 3 halves. So that looks like square root of 3 over 2 times the standard Gaussian random variable. And E hat is distributed like F2, F3, F2, F3, normal 0, identity 2. And these things are independent. So the probability of EB, I'm almost there, is the probability that this guy is greater than or equal to the norm of this guy. Over square root of 2. And that's So one disadvantage Archimedes had is he was born before Gauss, so he didn't know about Gaussian random variables. So what are we going to do about that? We've got these three independent Gaussian vectors, F1, F2, F3. Well, go back to the first half. We're going to scale them so that it gets on the unit sphere, and then F1, F2, F3 is uniformly distributed on the unit sphere. And now Archimedes is happy. So I can scale things. It looks like, say, G1 greater or equal to 1 over square root of 3 G2 G3 G1 G2 G3 uniform on the unit sphere. And the unit sphere, everything has length 1, and you play around with this a little bit. Oh, half. And you see it's this. And this is something Archimedes knew everything about. So it says we look at a unit sphere, and we look at the probability that a uniform vector is has first component greater or equal to a half. So we look at the spherical cap, or we look at the area of this, the relative area of this compared to the unit sphere. And what did Archimedes know? He knew that we could get these things by projecting onto the cylinder circumscribing. And so the probability that G1 is greater or equal to half is the ratio of that surface area of the cylinder to the whole surface area, and that's a quarter. So there's the proof. It's relatively short, but it's also slightly unsatisfactory. So the nice thing about it is it gets back to Archimedes, and if any of you haven't read a book called Archimedes Codex, this is about a manuscript that was discovered and rediscovered and so forth, and finally deciphered in the last 10 years or so. It had been in the library at Alexandria and got burned up, but one copy was in a library in Istanbul. And in the Middle Ages, some monk was looking for some papyrus to put a prayer book on, and they run out. So they got this thing, and they washed it with all sorts of nasty acids, and then wrote prayers and things all over it. But, you know, there was a little bit of a hint of what was behind. So then this was bought by some very rich, everyone is trying to guess who it is, but anyway, a certain museum in Philadelphia was trying to get hold of it, this rich tech-savvy guy bought it, but then allowed them to do the deciphering and so forth. And they got in touch with incredibly high-powered vision people and high-energy physics people who couldn't destroy it, but were trying to figure out what was there. And they figured out, basically, that Archimedes knew integral calculus. I mean, some of these things he knew, but he really had the whole principles there. They're just spectacular. Anyway, so Archimedes is really great. And, you know, in doing this, we went down from the original 6 variables down to 3 where we could do this. So Edelman and Strang also got it down to something on the unit sphere. They had a slightly weirder set that they set up, but that was also down to 3. Portnoy did something very similar, but he got down to 4. And then he used some things about chi-squared random variables, but those are a little bit more complicated. And he was looking directly at this, E-delta or EA, where you had a quadratic thing, and so you had to have 4 variables instead of just the 3. So I think this is relatively simple. But it should be simpler, right? The answer is so simple, this is Occam's razor, there should be a simpler way to do it. And also, there should be a reason of explaining why you get exactly the same answer if you choose some other distributions. So, I don't know what your favorite way of generating a random triangle. I don't know if you wake up, oh, it's Friday, I have to come up with a way to do a random triangle. Various people have come up with saying, well, let's just do uniform on the angles, subject to the angles adding up to pi. There, it's very, very easy to see the answer as a quarter. But when you see something like this, you want to use some invariancing, some reflection, some symmetry operations. You want to see what's going on. So here's another way of generating the points. You can take a unit circle and then you can choose the points on the unit circle uniformly at random on the circle. There they are, acute. So it turns out that if you do that, the angles are uniform, so that's another way of doing it. But this is a nice sort of way. You can see it has this nice rotational symmetry, just like Rand N does. And there's a very cute proof that the answer is a quarter here. So why is it a quarter? Well, let's suppose B and C are here. And where is the triangle going to be acute? The triangle is going to be acute. Let's do 90 degrees up here and 90 degrees up here. And if A is anywhere up here, the triangle will be acute. And if A is anywhere down here, A will have angle bigger than 90 degrees. And, you know, that's a nice measure-preserving thing because it's 90 degrees. This is directly opposite there. This is directly opposite there. And this thing has exactly the same measure as that, and therefore it's a quarter. So that's a beautiful argument. And Gaussian random variables have all sorts of nice symmetries too. Can't you do something nice for those? Well, I couldn't. And I spent some time on my pillow, you know, thinking about what would be a possible approach. I don't recommend it. You don't get so much sleep. And then eventually I came up with this, which was okay, but this is a challenge to you. You know, it's the end of the day, so try to figure out a nice proof that when you'd have the Gaussian. And okay, so I should mention, what other distributions are there? Well, there's Lewis Carroll's, which was sort of conditional on B and C being the longest one. Let's see where A is, and it's uniform in the part of the plane it can remain in, but it's very asymmetric, and it doesn't look as it really corresponds to a distribution on you know, the original triples that has any sort of symmetry to it at all. We generated Rand N 2, 3. What if you generate Rand N 2, sorry, D 3? Generate 3 points in D-dimensional space. They span a triangle in some plane that they determine. What's the probability that triangle is acute? Any ideas? One. Right, you know, we're thinking of D large, right? One. Remember I told you in the first thing, you take two random vectors, they're almost always orthogonal. What does it mean that they're orthogonal? They also have about the same length, right? Because we're adding up the sums of squares of a whole bunch of different things, so they all have length about square root of n, and they're orthogonal, so their distance is square root of 2n. And that holds for all three of them. It's not just an acute triangle, it's pretty much an equilateral triangle. So as the dimension gets larger, even though you think there's this sort of rotational symmetry, no, those things just about make an equilateral triangle. So maybe the geometrical books that you look at are all thinking of projections of very high dimensional things. But, you know, here's this nice rotational symmetry. What other distributions could we take for the radius that we'll get a quarter? This thing works. If I do the same thing and make their distances, what, square root of a chi-squared random variable 2 degrees of freedom, I'll get the normal. And I'll get a quarter, but you could choose something else. I mean, my favorite is always the Cauchy because it's got, and then probability it's acute is basically zero because there's always one thing shooting way, way out. So I don't know what, you know, the key property is, but it's fun to think about it. Just for these two, I would like the same argument to work. So that's it.